Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to Bletchley. It's an odd thing that I'm here, and it's a sort of strange coincidence because when I was in the army, I knew about Bletchley. Well, every army person did. And I came here about 4 years ago filming with my youngest son. We were filming some sort of daft TV program that had a sort of a code-breaking element to it. So I ended up here. And I was completely gobsmacked by what I saw. In my naive way, I'd assumed that a country values sufficiently its real assets to look after them. I just couldn't understand it. Buildings falling down, and the place desperately needed funds. So from that day, I thought, right, well, we must all do something about it. I wrote a proposal for the BBC and did a short film which we showed at Cannes to get the various people interested. And it wasn't desperately successful in that it's led the BBC to do, we've done two or three elements of Bletchley rather than the whole story of Bletchley and how important it is. That we still think will be done. And as ever, it's funding that is the problem. But I won't give up on that, because the entire story should be told in one simple package or a film that can be shown at schools, can be at libraries, can go all the way around the world. And if somebody says that B word, Bletchley, then they understand what it did and what it achieved. But today is about Alan Turing, who was an exceptional man. As an army man, I was in Germany, just, I suppose, the end of the Cold War in 1970. And a lot of things have happened when we went racing up to the border loaded with a nuclear shell in each of our tanks, ready to lob them. That now, coming back to Bletchley, I realised what was driving the radio traffic that actually made us go up to the borders. But that's another issue for later today. What I'm interested in is the fact that so many, particularly young people, don't know the name Turing. And you think, how is that possible? World War II was about freedom. It was about maintaining our freedom and not being ruled by others in a way that we didn't want to be ruled, and to maintain freedom of speech and freedom of action, and to be able to do what we wanted in our lives. And from that war, famous names came out of it, which we all know. Churchill, Eisenhower, Patton, Montgomery, these roll off your tongue. The one that doesn't roll off everybody's tongue is Turing. And if you think about the purpose of the war was to fight for freedom, then if this one man and the team that, of course, was with him shortened the war by some 2 years, they say, maybe more, and with all the lives that saved, but also raises the question, and it's an interesting one, is that if Turing and his team didn't exist, could we have won the war? And I think the answer, as an army man, was no. I don't think we would have. We were struggling anyway, as we all know. So this one person helped more to maintain freedom and secure it than any one person that I know of in British history. So that puts him in the correct place in history. And it's ironic that the freedom for which he did so much to secure was denied to him in his personal life, which did not affect anyone. It was a private affair between him and his friend, his partner. And when he was arrested, he was quite open about it. There was nothing to be ashamed of, and talked to the police in a very open way, and was rather bemused and confused that this freedom should be something that should be denied when you look back on what had happened in the previous years and the whole of the Second World War. And, of course, when he was at school at Sherborne, he had a very close relationship with Christopher Morcombe, who tragically died very young. And it hugely affected Alan Turing's life. But what it did, from everything that I've read about Alan Turing, friends, people that knew him, and family, which we've got Sir John here sitting in front of me, is that this tragic event got him to examine what modern science could say about the mind, because his friend was no longer with him except in his mind and in his thoughts. And so he started to really examine what science could do. Could it replace neurons in the brain? Could science actually start to think? Could a machine start to think like the brain? And if it could, how? And in 1950, he produced, after obviously the war, he produced this paper called The Mind. And I don't know how many of you read it, but it's fascinating. And the whole paper was entitled, Can Machines Think? Can a computer or a machine replace neurons? Of course, we all know, sitting here in Bletchley, in 1936, he built the Turing machine, which answered a question that mathematicians have been asking since the 1870s and 1880s, the great mathematicians of the world. And here was a bloke that came along, he didn't even call himself a mathematician, and just came up with a solution, the Turing machine, which was the blueprint of the modern digital computer. And that completely got the attention of the whole academic world globally. And then, of course, in 1944, spring of 1944, the first Colossus machine was operational. And that was the world's first programmable computer. Mention that to an American, and I might have one or two in this room, and I've got lots of American friends, but it always amuses me. We prepared a thing for a TV program that we'll hopefully be doing, the definitive program on British firsts. Well, I've got the list of British firsts here, and I won't bore you with it because it runs into five pages of A4, and that's one entry per line of every invention that changed the world. So you think of inventions that changed the world. What is the biggest invention that changed the world? Well, we know the steam engine and various other things we can think of. But the world as we now know it and it's becoming, undoubtedly, in my mind, it's the computer. A little chip drives everything. Your phone, it drives the fridge that I can hear running around the corner, or whatever it is, the equipment, everything. Everything is driven by a chip. And so that invention, probably, is the most important invention besides the wheel. And we'll probably get rid of things on wheels soon anyway. I want to just read you very quickly. There is a Uruguayan author called Eduardo Galeano. He's very famous. You may or may not have heard of him, but in England he's not so famous. But in the rest of the Latin American world, he is very well known. And he recently produced a book called Mirrors. And just so you know, he's quite well known. President Hugo Chavez, in his last recent visit to Barack Obama, gave him Galeano's new book, which is called The Open Veins of Latin America, and it became an overnight bestseller since that book was given to Obama. So he says in Mirrors, all of us should, when we turn on our computer, begin by saying thank you to the inventor of the computer, the father, who was an Englishman called Alan Turing. And as I read this text, because the book includes some stories, being as it is a homage to human diversity, and includes some stories about sexual diversity, which is also a treasure of a humankind. Because the best we have, so many people inside, like mirrors, the best of the world is, in so many words, the world contains the human rainbow full of colours. Now, he's really a poet, this guy. But what he's saying is that what this man did was truly extraordinary. And in his short life, he was a truly extraordinary man. quite apart from the fact that he was a runner as fast as most of our Olympic runners, actually faster than one of them, and decided, Wimbledon's on now, that he was lightning quick at the net because his mind was so fast, but 50% of his shots used to go into the net. And so he went away to his desk and worked out the reason why, and that was the strings were too tight, so he loosened them, and which, of course, had a deadening effect when he played the net, and the balls just dropped the other side, and, of course, the opponent couldn't get them. Except that if you looked at it in slow motion, it was sort of two actions. One was to catch the ball, and the other was to drop it, which was not considered quite cricket, if you see what I mean. But it was a wonderful example of how his mind worked. So what I wanted to end with is this. On my flight back yesterday from France to come here, there's a show at the moment called Made in Chelsea. It's a bit daft, but there's a guy on it called Spencer. And I met him, I recognised him, and he said, what are you doing in London tomorrow? I said, well, actually, I'm a Bletchley, about a chap called Touring. Well, you know it's going to come happen, I don't know. Who's Touring? So I thought, well, this is what today's about and the future's about, to make sure that people know. I said, well, you've heard of Winston Churchill, yes. Wayne Rooney? Yeah. Bob Diamond, bastard, yes. Head of the bank. But Fred the Shred, yeah. Alan Turing, well, I mean, in that list of names I've just given you, where does Alan Turing come? Well, certainly alongside Churchill. It's a different type of leadership, but equally as famous, and in his contribution to the world, much more than Winston Churchill. So I said to him, where do you think, when I told him what Alan Turing did in the queue, I said, how do you think we ought to honour him? And he said, well, there's a bleeding plinth empty in Trafalgar Square, isn't there? Well, I thought he might only be 24, this bloke, but he's got the right idea, because actually that's somewhere appropriate for somebody like Alan Turing, not some daft bit of modern art that will blow away in the next gale. So we are here today to honour Alan Turing and to remember actually what he did, as well as to look forward. Now, we've got in front of us here Sir John Dermot Turing, who has kindly given up some time to come here. And Sir John would like, or Dermot as he's known, would like to say a few words. And so, Dermot, over to you.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Can I also add my welcome to Bletchley Park? It's a great pleasure to be here today and to be part of an event celebrating the centenary of Alan Turing's birth in June 1912. I'm sure you all know this, but Alan Turing was one of the so-called men of the professor type, who were earmarked by the thing called the Government Code and Cipher School before the Second World War started to set up the code-breaking effort in case Chamberlain's effort to secure peace with honour were to fail. With all that language, it all sounds very sort of quaint. It sounds definitely pre-war. Just to give you a flavour of it, when Alan got his call and reported for duty on the 4th of September 1939, there were 9 men of the professor type here at Bletchley Park. And on the day after, another 7 men of the professor type arrived. And it's quite extraordinary because within a few years, this place had turned into an intelligence factory, and all the huts and brick buildings that you see here today had to be put together during the wartime to achieve that intelligence machine. It's quite remarkable. And I think expansion from the few men of the professor type into that factory was extremely challenging, particularly in the time after the fall of France, when Britain was alone and facing that threat from the U-boats, and every single part of the country and the armed forces were fighting for resources. It's remarkable that Bletchley managed to achieve that expansion, and I don't think that could have been done without Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was an enthusiastic supporter of code-breaking based on his experience as a minister during the First World War. And when he became Prime Minister in 1940, he was extremely keen to support Bletchley, and he visited Bletchley a couple of times, but notably in the summer of 1941. And that was partly to give a pep talk, but it's also because he actually wanted to look under the bonnet. He was absolutely fascinated by how it was done. And at that point, Bletchley was really on the rocks. It was really struggling for resources. And I think it's quite interesting that four of these men of the professor type did something completely unheard of. You just absolutely don't do this if you're in the army, and you probably don't do it if you're in the civil service either, which is that you go over the head of your boss and you write to your boss's boss. And so that's what these four professors did, and that was Alan Turing, Gordon Welshman, Hugh Alexander and Stuart Milner Barry, who are all very well-known code-breaking names here at Bletchley Park. And they wrote direct to Churchill to tell him straight what the problems were. And then, of course, Churchill actually read the letter. That was the amazing bit. Churchill actually read the letter. And then he did one of those awful things. He put one of his really quite scary Action This Day stickers on the letter and scrawled, I mean, it's very difficult to read his handwriting, but what it says is, "General, I may make sure they have all they want on extreme priority and report to me that this has been done. WSC, 22nd of October." Right, next point. There's been a recent parallel with that, and Lord Brockett was alluding to this in his presentation. I mean, I expect you've noticed that some of the huts around here are not exactly what you'd call in mint condition, in particular huts 3 and 6, where the Army and Air Force Enigma traffic were handled. They're looking a bit crumbly. Well, what I'm pleased to say is that just this week we were able to announce that the Bletchley Park Trust has put the final pieces in place to fund the restoration of those huts and to develop a new visitor centre and exhibition space in Block C, which is in one of the rather tatty brick-built buildings, which is just down by the entrance gate. And during the war, that's where the card index, which was essentially the information management system at Bletchley Park, was maintained. So, I mean, it's very great news that we've not only been able to do that, but it's very great personal pleasure that we've been able to do and make that and achieve that step during the week of the centenary of Alan Turing's birth. So that's very nice sort of symmetry to it. However, I have to tell you that's only the first step in our plan of actually getting Bletchley Park back onto its feet and securing it for the future on a long-term basis. What we really want to do is to transform Bletchley Park into a world-class heritage and education centre. And that means that what we want to do is to improve and expand the museum into Block D, which is the, if you thought Block C was pretty crummy and the huts are crumbling, you should go and have a look at Block D, which is sort of, it's another one of the brick-built buildings on that side of the site, and I would say it's nearly derelict. But anyway, we're going to try and restore that and other buildings of historical significance on the site and hopefully transform this into a lasting and very important piece of Britain's heritage. So I'm afraid you won't be allowed to leave here with your pockets still bulging with cash. I'm afraid, you know, you're kind enough to have come. We will be kind enough to relieve you of your wallets on the way out. And do tell your friends. Anyway, today actually is primarily about Alan Turing, and I just thought I'd give you a little bit of sort of personal history on this. In the family, we really had very little knowledge until the late 1970s about what Alan had actually done here at Bletchley Park. Everybody knew that there had been a code-breaking effort during the war. That was not hugely a secret, and the fact that there had been one in the First World War and had been talked about in Parliament in the interwar period meant that people, you know, I mean, it didn't take a lot of sort of extrapolation to work out that you put a bunch of people together at Bletchley Park and they are sort of mathematicians and linguists and people like that, and there must be a code-breaking effort going on somewhere, that was what was going on here. But what you didn't know was the scale of it, the significance of it, what its operational and strategic impact had had, and we certainly didn't know what Alan Turing's role had actually been here, or indeed whether that was a major or a minor one. So in 1977, the BBC put together a series on called The Secret War, and we all crowded around a small black and white portable TV at home to find out what Alan Turing had actually been doing during the war. And that's how we found out. And I think that it's fair to say that since then, since the early 1980s when Andrew Hodges' biography came out, then people have had a greater understanding of what Alan Turing did, and indeed the contributions that he'd made on the intellectual front in the fields of morphogenesis and computer science and artificial intelligence, all things which we're going to hear more about today, as well as his role in the code breaking, and what impact that's had on thought and indeed sort of our practical daily lives. His reputation has grown immensely in the last 30 years. Today's programme, which I'm really looking forward to, has got really trying to cover the whole field there, and I think that just shows you how remarkable Alan Turing's legacy is. Although he was born 100 years ago last week, he died before he reached his 42nd birthday, and many people have remarked to me in the last two or three weeks what might have been if he had lived longer. But I think what we should try and do today is to focus on make this a celebration of what he did manage to achieve during his short life, and there's plenty to stimulate the grey matter, and I hope you'll find today an interesting and very enjoyable day. Thank you very much.
Dermot said, does anyone have any questions that you would like to ask him whilst he's here?
So how do you have the Turing name? Your relationship to Alan?
I was asked my relationship to Alan Turing, and the answer is I'm his nephew. He was my uncle. The question was, did we talk in the family about Alan's work? The answer really is no, and there's two reasons for that. One of them obviously is the work at Bletchley, which is I think the stuff that's most accessible to the sort of general person in the street, such as me. You know, that was shrouded in secrecy until, as I say, about 30 years ago. The other reason I think is that, frankly, you can go and study the papers yourself down in the exhibition in Block B. It's pretty challenging for sort of lesser mortals. If you haven't got a maths degree, you're going to find some of this pretty tough. And actually, that's what's good about having something like today, where we're going to have people who do understand it, who are going to explain it to people like us. So I'm really quite looking forward to that. So.
Do you remember Alan? And if so, what do you remember about him?
Right, you can leave the room immediately, because I may be as crumbly as Hutt's three and six, but unfortunately, do the maths. He died in 1954. I was born in 1961. So
I think that's we don't have a mathematician over there. Are you sure you've got the right event today?
All right, let me debunk a myth. Alan Turing did not invent the computer. Let's sort of put his work into perspective. Like, I mean, it's also a myth that Alan Turing single-handedly broke the codes and invented the Colossus and pulled apart the Enigma. All these things are team efforts. What I think Alan Turing's contribution is, in terms of who invented the computer, is that he wrote this seminal paper in 1936, which was called On Computable Numbers, which, and Lord Brockett mentioned this in his presentation, set out essentially a blueprint for a thing called a universal computing machine. And just think yourself back into the 1930s. Some of you who are older than me may just about be able to do that. But you think yourself back into the 1930s, where machinery was basically single-purpose machinery. You could go and, if you had the money, go and buy an adding machine where you sort of cranked a handle and it would actually, you know, you had to crank it a lot, but essentially it was a mechanized abacus and it would actually add up for you. But that was a single-purpose machine. You could buy electronic versions of that which would be able to do more complicated things based on relays and what have you. But what the vision was in his 1936 paper was a machine which could be adapted by programming it to do essentially what they didn't call them programs in those days, they called them instruction tables. You could give the machine a different instruction table and then it'd be able to perform a different task. And it was that vision that the program could be treated like a piece of data and therefore changed to make the machine carry out a different function. That was the intellectual contribution that he made. What I'm not telling you is that he invented the semiconductor. I'm not telling you that he invented the valve. I'm not telling you that he put together the engineering blueprints for the Colossus machine. And I'm not telling you that he invented apps in the way that Bill Gates managed to do. What he did do also in 1947, I think it was, 46, 47, was actually he drafted essentially a guide to programming, which was how you actually set up these instruction tables. And that was obviously very important in terms of helping people who wanted to develop software, that concept that sort of didn't exist at the time. So he had some key roles during that process, but I think we should just be slightly wary of overselling this man.
Do you think it's fair to call him the father of computers?
That probably is fair, but there'd be as many people in this room who would disagree with that statement as there are that would agree with it.
Can I just make a remark there? I think this is what this is all part of. 5 years ago, Bletchley was never in the news, well, hardly ever. Now, you know, everyone's waking up to the fact that, A, what it did, and who worked here, and what they did here. So I think it's all part of education, and hopefully in time, a shortish time, people will know what happened here, and the contributions made by all the people that worked here, and some of the geniuses who are sitting here today around us, and, you know, Jerry and Margaret and other people. You know, so this is all education, and I agree, it needs to happen.
We don't have any academic papers. When Alan Turing died, he made a will which set out what was going to happen to his stuff, and all the academic things were essentially entrusted to essentially what you might call an academic curator. So we don't have that.
Thank you very much.